I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This was a scenario we didn't want. The words of Joe Manchin, the governor of West Virginia, stating the obvious, as dangerous gases forced rescue crews to halt their search for four coal miners missing since an explosion killed 25 on Monday. Rescuers entered the Upper Big Branch mine in Montcoal before dawn today after crews drilled holes to try to ventilate the methane gas, which has been blamed for the explosion. But tests indicated the air in the mine was still too explosive, and officials ordered the evacuation. Beth Voorhees of West Virginia Public Radio joins us again. And Beth, tell us more about why these teams were pulled from the mine. It had to be disappointing.
It was a devastating setback. As a matter of fact, I'm told by our reporters who were on the scene at the press briefing that once the governor and mine officials had told them what they did, there was an audible gasp in the room. We've waited for days for holes to be punched through this mine to ventilate it, to bring fresh air in. We finally get these rescue crews into the mine, only to find out that they had to turn back within 1,000 feet of one of these rescue chambers, and then having to turn back and wait. They'll punch another hole through the mine. They'll pump some more fresh air in, continue to monitor the situation of the toxic gases inside the mine, and see if they can't go back in a few hours.
Meanwhile, can you give us a sense of what the rescuers did see when they were in there?
No, we have no indication what they did see. Of course, we do know that there are bodies of the perished miners there. They were able to bring out a few of them. But other than that, yeah, we don't know what else they saw.
Well, it's got to be horrendous because, you know, there were the explosions in there and it's dark and dusty. But what's the plan now?
Well, the plan now
is just to wait for the drill.
Just to wait for the drill is almost through, to bring in some more fresh air, to continue to monitor it, and then to send the rescue teams back in. There are 32 team members in four teams. They'll go back in, get into another man trip, the car that brings people in and out of the mine, go as far as they can, and then walk into the mine. Families of the dead and the missing understand why this had to happen. They want to make sure that the rescue workers themselves are kept safe.
Yeah. Well, Beth, we spoke yesterday about past violations against the mine and the controversial, colorful owner, Don Blankenship. We're reading two views of him today. Workers saying that he had a fixation with profit. He oversaw a bitter strike in the 80s, and the company is now non-union, but also he calls the miners members, not employees. He hosts them at a 4th of July celebration with Ted Nugent headlining. Many of the workers fly the Massey flag. What's the sense today and, you know, going forward of how this mine goes forward?
We don't know how this mine will go forward. But we know from experience, for instance, in the Sago mine disaster, after that mine was cleaned up, it did reopen. It's closed now because it wasn't profitable. Another Massey mine was involved in a mine fire where two miners died, the Aracoma mine. That situation was rectified and improved, and the mine did reopen. So we'll have to see what happens to Massey Energy and this mine. Of course, it will take a long time for an investigation. An investigative team from MSHA has been appointed, and they will look at every aspect. But it's going to be a long time before we find out exactly what happened and if this mine can be reopened.
Yeah. And is the how about the workers' feeling about Don Blankenship? Is it still sort of divided along, you know, the lines of the people who feel he's interested in profits and the people who are thankful that he's their boss?
Yeah, you know, Don Blankenship, it just depends on who you talk to. There are many people, you know, he has 16 mines in West Virginia. He employs thousands of people. But there are others. He has his detractors who resent that he got involved in West Virginia politics. How you feel about Don Blankenship is how you feel about Don Blankenship, I'm afraid.
And by the way, we've gotten emails from people who wanted it pointed out that it's a non-union mine, but we're reading that they make good pay, although their benefits are maybe a little less than in other mines. That's Beth Voorhees with West Virginia Public Radio, keeping an eye on this story there. Beth, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
Now to the Middle East. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he's weighing a response to American opposition to continued construction of housing units for Jews in East Jerusalem. Speaking at a press conference yesterday, Netanyahu said simply there are things we agree on and things we don't agree on. You'll remember the announcement that Israel was going to build 1,600 new units in the city initially came during a visit to Israel by Vice President Joe Biden, angering President Obama, who saw it as a snub. The Israeli government apologized to the U.S. for what it said was poor timing on the announcement, but publicly rejected the American demand that the country freeze construction in most Jewish neighborhoods of East Jerusalem. Reza Aslan has just returned from Israel. He's the author of Beyond Fundamentalism, Confronting Religious Extremism in the Age of Globalization. He's also a contributing editor at the Daily Beast. He's going to start us off on a look at the aftermath of that incident in Israel. And Reza, you were there as this diplomatic crisis broke. What's the mood in Israel now?
I think that, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu and his right-wing coalition has really created a zero hour in which people now recognize that they can either join with the international community, give in to the demands of the Obama administration, and move forward on the peace process in hopes of building a two-state solution, or that this is sort of the moment in which Israel decides to go at it alone and maintain the status quo. And I think the results of that could be quite disastrous.
With Iran over their shoulder, would Israel really want to go it alone?
Well, this is, of course, the Trump card. The debate was either go it alone and deal with Iran on our own, or obey Obama and get American support for what they refer to as the Iran problem. The really surprising thing that happened while I was in Israel is that it seemed at first that the Israeli population was behind Benjamin Netanyahu and his insistence on, quote-unquote, standing up to the United States. But then after a few days during this crisis, a poll came out that showed that almost 70% of Israelis supported President Obama's stand, believed that Obama was a friend to Israel, that he had Israel's best intentions and its security at heart. And 40% believed that Benjamin Netanyahu was at fault. Again, it shows once again that the population of Israel, this secular, intelligent, miraculous population that has survived so much, is still very much in the pro-peace, pro-U.S. camp. Unfortunately, the minority, particularly those in the ultra-Orthodox Shas or in the ultra-nationalist Yisrael Beitenu parties, have so much political power, so disproportionate to their numbers and their popularity, that they can make sure that no two-state solution ever happens as long as they're in control.
Well, in fact, what do you think about what everyone always saw as endgame, a two-state solution?
Robin, I have to tell you, I've spent 2 weeks going up and down the country speaking to Israelis and Palestinians, both Palestinians in the occupied territories and those who are citizens of Israel proper. And I have to tell you that I can say today with confidence what practically everyone I spoke to in that country knows to be true but is too afraid to admit publicly, and that is that the prospect for a two-state solution in which a safe and secure Israel lives alongside an independent and economically viable Palestine is dead and it's buried. And there are plenty of people that you can blame for that. You can blame certainly the Palestinian leadership and its geriatric leaders. You can blame Hamas, of course, and the militants who have taken over Gaza and made the possibility of a united Palestinian state really a joke at this point. You can certainly blame the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. I want to always remind people that we're talking about a government, the Likud government, whose founding charter, quote, flatly rejects the establishment of a Palestinian Arab state west of the Jordan River. And frankly, unless the Obama administration is willing to say that there are certain consequences for Israel's refusal to cease settlement activity, it's very hard to imagine that this coalition is going to give in. Look, the issue is this. Currently, right now, there's about an equal number of Israelis and Palestinians living between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea, about 5 million each. But every demographer will tell you that in the next decade, the Palestinians will greatly outnumber the Israelis. And without an actual Palestinian state of their own, the very possibility of a Jewish majority state will cease to exist, which means essentially the very purpose of the state of Israel, the state that has miraculously survived six decades in this, you know, quite unfriendly region, that the very purpose of it as a majority state will also cease to exist.
What's the sense of what has to happen to avoid this path?
Well, we have to have some kind of breakthrough in these next, I'd say, 12 to 18 months. Otherwise, we are looking at something that, frankly, no Israeli or Palestinian wants, and that is the much talked about and mythological one-state solution, the binational state in which Israelis and Palestinians live together in a single state, which, you know, honestly sounds crazy considering everything that's happened in the last 60 years. But again, I just want to say, as crazy as that sounds, when you talk to Israelis and Palestinians, you know, what they say is that, well, we're sort of almost there anyway. I mean, these are two people that share the same business economy. They have the same currency. They share the same labor laws, the same water resources. Yes, they are culturally distinct. Yes, they want political autonomy. But in many ways, they're already two pieces of a global village, distinct from each other, no doubt. But with every passing day, they are closer to this possibility of a single people living on a single piece of land.
It just seems impossible.
It does seem impossible, and frankly, the vast majority of public opinion amongst both Israelis and Palestinians reject the option of a one-state solution. And, you know, considering all the violence and the mistrust, the idea that they would live as one people in one state seems absurd. It's not as far-fetched or crazy as it seems. And in fact, we have seen other situations, not just in South Africa, of course, but in Belgium and Cyprus. I agree with you. It seems impossible, but that is where we are inexorably leading to.
But Israel has a functioning democracy. Palestinians have a very fledgling one in one part of the territories. I mean, is there a sense that they're ready for this one state you speak of?
Without question, one of the biggest obstacles, not just to this one-state solution that I'm referring to, but to the two-state solution, is the division between Hamas and Fatah. This is just one of many, many problems that seem really unsolvable at this point without the political will necessary on all sides, not just amongst the Palestinians and the Israelis, but here in the United States, to force a solution to this conflict. Otherwise, as I say, the consequences will be what at this point nobody wants, which is a single state. You know, I had a friend of mine, I was asking him whether he was thinking about buying a house, and he said, why? We've got about 10 years left, and, you know, before this country ceases to exist. You know, that attitude has descended upon the population there.
That's Risa Aslan. His forthcoming book is Beyond Fundamentalism, Confronting Religious Extremism in the Age of Globalization. Risa, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Well, Risa gives us a lot to chew on. Is the two-state solution dead? Is Israel at a ground zero? Zero hour. Is there a solution? We're going to bring in a longtime observer of the region who says no, yes, maybe. Also later today, if you supported Haiti this year after the earthquake, you did a good thing, of course, but you also may be rewarded for it in last year's tax return. We'll explain tax tips coming up, but more on the Middle East in 1 minute here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We just heard from author Risa Aslan, who recently spent time in Israel and concluded that the two-state solution is dead. He says he meets people in the area increasingly saying a one-state solution may be unavoidable and that Israel is at a zero hour. Professor Asher Susser is a senior fellow in Arab politics at Brandeis University's Crown Center for Middle East Studies. He's also a senior researcher at the Moshe Dayan Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Tel Aviv University. He joins us in the studio. Professor, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
So Risa said a lot of things. He said it's zero hour. The Israelis have to decide whether to abide by some of the requests from the Obama administration or go it alone. He says the two-state solution is dead. What do you think?
Well, I think that the two-state solution is not dead, although there obviously are great difficulties in turning the two-state solution into a reality. But the notion that because of the difficulties facing the two-state solution, that a one-state solution is the alternative option, is, I think, very mistaken. The one-state idea is, as Aslan pointed out, is not very popular either in Palestine or in Israel for good reason. And the one-state so-called solution would probably be a lot worse than the present situation.
Well, but during the break, you said to me, I agree with him.
But I agree with him that we're at 0 hour and that we will eventually, by doing nothing, create a one-state reality, which will indeed be a disaster. The Israelis, therefore, have to make up their minds. And I think he also mentioned the fact that polls in Israel suggest that there still is, and has been for a long time, a constant majority in Israel supporting the two-state idea. The Minister of Defense in Netanyahu's government, Ehud Barak, who comes from the Labor Party, is a great supporter of the two-state idea and speaks now of the urgency of creating a two-state solution, precisely for the reason that Reza Aslan mentioned. But it is true that this government has a very right-wing bent, which is not serving the cause of the two-state solution.
But would you say that if Netanyahu stepped forward and said, you know what, it is such an irritant, why would we build 1,600 new units in East Jerusalem? It's such a provocation. We will give in on that notion. We will stop building settlements in the West Bank, even more than we've agreed to stop building settlements. What does that leave, though?
Personally, I think, like I think many Israelis also think, that it would be a good idea if Israel did stop the settlement building in the West Bank, which Netanyahu, by the way, has agreed to do. And as for the building in Jerusalem, I think one has to make a distinction between two different things.
Exactly. This is not a settlement. It's a Jewish neighborhood.
Building in a Jewish neighborhood essentially doesn't really mean that much. I mean, it is already agreed between Israel and the Palestinians that when Jerusalem is divided, and not if, but when Jerusalem is divided, it will be divided in a manner in which Jewish residential areas become Israel and Arab residential areas become Palestine.
But what it telegraphed was building more units. And in an area, maybe, you know, you can debate where it is, but it's at least close to where Palestinians see their future capital.
Yeah, but it's the real problem in Jerusalem is not that. The real problem in Jerusalem is when Israelis build or take over buildings in Arab residential areas. That is the real provocation.
So you agree that Netanyahu and should stop being provocative. But on the other hand, what do you do about the other question, which is who leads the Palestinians?
This is a real, a huge obstacle to a solution. The fact that the Palestinians are divided between Fatah and Hamas, and I don't think there's going to be a reconciliation between them anytime soon. But the Palestinians are taking serious moves precisely because of this 0 hour. To build the institutions of a Palestinian state under the auspices of the present Prime Minister, Salam Fayyad, which Israel is not preventing. There is very effective security maintained throughout the West Bank, which is not only important in terms of security vis-a-vis Israel, but law and order for the people of Palestine. That is working far better than anyone would have expected. So in that respect, the institutions of the Palestinian state in the making are going in a direction that we have not seen for decades. The Palestinians are taking action on the ground unilaterally to keep the two-state idea alive.
Well, in just the couple minutes we have, you mentioned the Prime Minister. This is not, I know what you mean. You're talking about real facts on the ground, but we saw the front page of the New York Times the other day, and it was Fayyad who was among the Palestinians embracing nonviolent resistance. They were building trees. Now, this was interesting to us because we were recently in the offices of Gene Sharp here in the Boston area. He has written the book on nonviolent resistance, and when we were in his office, he was scheduling a teleconference meeting with Palestinians to learn more about this, and now we feel we're seeing it implemented. Your thoughts on seeing Palestinians take a third way, not diplomacy, not violence, but resistance, not buying Jewish settlers' goods, not working for the settlers. Is that a viable way?
It's certainly something that the Palestinians can do, will do, but I don't think that's going to change very much. The real issue here is for both the Israelis and the Palestinians to come to the conclusion that irrespective of what it is that the Americans may be pushing for, it's the Israelis and the Palestinians more than anyone else who need a two-state solution. What may happen if Salam Fayyad continues with this unilateral project of building the institutions of the Palestinian state? that Israel may allow this to continue. And essentially, we could have a situation in which there are coordinated unilateral actions taken by both sides to keep the two-state idea alive, even if there is not an active negotiation producing real results. This is where I think the Israelis and the Palestinians may be going, which is not resolving all issues for all time, but it is taking action on the ground to keep the two-state solution alive, the realization on both sides being that the alternative is far worse. This is where the United States could play a very, very positive role in helping the Israelis and the Palestinians to coordinate these various actions, like building the institutions of the Palestinian state, while the Israelis remove roadblocks, etc., and allow the Palestinian economy to flourish, which is what is happening now. And maybe the Israelis could redeploy further in the West Bank. What the U.S. must do is to help the Palestinians and the Israelis to get where the great majority of them, on both sides, want to get. And that is to keep a two-state idea viable.
That's Professor Asher Susser, a senior fellow in Arab politics at Brandeis University's Crown Center for Middle East Studies, also a senior researcher at the Moshe Dayan Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Tel Aviv University. Professor, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Okay, still to come, tax tips after the latest news here and now. Tiger Woods returns to professional golf at the Masters in Augusta, Georgia today, and everyone is talking about his commercial. It's Woods' first Nike ad since the revelation of his infidelities. It features a black-and-white image of a remorseful-looking Tiger and audio of his late father, Earl, talking to his son.
I want to find out what your thinking was. I want to find out what your feelings are. And did you learn anything?
Well, there is also another voice speaking to Woods. In the present day, Augusta National Club Chairman Bill Payne rebuked Tiger during his annual Masters address. Sean Gregory is with Time Magazine. Sean, first of all, your thoughts on the ad.
Yeah, it struck me the wrong way. I really didn't like it. I thought it was inappropriate. I mean, okay, so here you have a guy using his infidelity to push products. I mean, that's how it comes across. I mean, this is Nike recalling Tiger's late father, who, you know, was no saint to begin with. So I just, the whole thing, it's just the wrong form for something like this. I mean, Nike can sell it as a teachable moment, but there's better places to get this message across of forgiveness and all that than an ad where the form just kind of gets across. We're going to use Tiger's scandal to help promote our brand. Give me a break.
Well, on the other hand, we're hearing ad executives say, brilliant, you know, what a great idea, because Nike, really, there's no way they could take advantage of Tiger Woods going back to the Masters without somehow referring to the scandal, and they think it was
taking advantage. I mean, is this the proper way to take advantage? I mean, we shouldn't be thinking about taking advantage here, and I think they stooped pretty low.
Well, then there was Augusta Chair Bill Payne speaking directly to Woods in his speech. Let's listen to a little of that.
It is not simply the degree of his conduct that is so egregious here. It is the fact that he disappointed all of us, and more importantly, our kids and our grandkids.
Well, this is hypocrite central. I mean, this is a guy whose club doesn't let women into, doesn't allow women's members. God, give me a break.
Well, but, it may be hypocritical, again, because Augusta still does not allow women members. But was it also unexpectedly harsh? I mean, were you surprised?
Yeah, I mean, Tiger, to his credit, has done a lot of public apologizing and introspection, and we get it. I mean, he's the first one to admit he's wrong. So now, do we really care what Billy Payne thinks? Does Billy Payne have to pile on? I thought it was inappropriate. If I was Tiger, I'd be upset. You know, but, you know, at this point, he gets it and is probably all rubbing off him at this point.
Well, that's our question. He plays this afternoon. He won the first of his 14 major championships at Augusta National in 97, but hasn't won the Masters since 2005, although he's been in contention. There's another story that's out that apparently on Monday, during a practice round, Tiger Woods' guards approached a woman in the gallery. Now, this is because one of the women involved with Tiger Woods had threatened to show up. So they asked this woman, ma'am, are you the stripper? And had a sheet of pictures of women that they were comparing her to. Now, this woman was not the stripper, and so they apologized to her and said, you know, we have to be careful. Well, are we going to see more of that? How's this going to impact Tiger's game?
I don't think it's going to be a circus. I don't think the women are going to get in and, you know, and it's a little bit ridiculous for them to be, you know, if a stripper wants to show up and pays to get in, I mean, what are they going to kick her out? I mean, she has every right to be there. I don't think that's going to be the distraction. I wouldn't be surprised if Tiger uses this Billy Payne stuff to motivate himself. He might just say, all right, this is enough. You know, I'm going to go out there and win this thing and get everybody talking about how good I am instead of all this whole circus.
And by the way, do we know how good he is? What is your sense of how well he'll do?
The reports from his practice rounds are that he's not that sharp. You know, he's hitting them long, but hitting them all over the place. And actually, his distance isn't what it normally is. So I think, you know, the gut feeling going in is that he's a little rusty. And, you know, if he doesn't make the cut, it wouldn't be a total surprise. But then again, it wouldn't be a total surprise if he wins the whole darn thing.
Sean Gregory of Time Magazine on Tiger Woods' return to professional golf at the Masters today and all the attendant hoopla. Sean, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And by the way, in poking around on YouTube, we found that Tiger's Nike ad is already being mocked, but we also found something we just had to share. It's 24-year-old shop worker Lin Yuchun stunning Taiwan's 1 million star show with his performance of I Will Always Love You. And pretty good, huh? We'll have his video along with Tiger's ad at our website, hereandnow.org. Back with tax tips here and now. Time is running out for procrastinators and the simply confused. April 15th is almost here, so let's answer some questions like regular IRA or Roth, or what tax deductions should we remember? Lawrence Anello joins us from Farmington, Connecticut. He's a certified public accountant and managing director of DHAS Financial Planning, which is a member of the Garrett Planning Network. Larry, let's start ticking off some things we should be thinking about. You say file in the states you've worked in, but does that really apply to a lot of people?
Well, we're finding that a lot of people, given the recession, have struck out on their own to become independent contractors and started their own businesses, and in doing so are venturing into states other than their home state to perform services. For example, we've had folks that have gone to conferences and state regulators have come back with the list of attendees, and sooner or later we get a letter indicating that we saw that you were attending our conference, and have you filed appropriate taxes in our state?
Interesting considerations. The crossing state lines question. You say also don't forget all the many tax credits that are out there. Name some.
Well, the important thing to recognize for tax credits, they are a dollar-for-dollar reduction in your taxes. So at this time of the year, we're really scrounging around for credits for our clients, things like first-time homebuyer credit, which could be as much as $8,000, education credits. There's some new credits that are available to the parents and also to the children. If the parents can't use the credits, children often have an opportunity to reduce their taxes with taking credits. Residential energy credits for buying insulated doors and windows, mm-hmm. and air conditioning system, et cetera.
Making work pay credit? What's that?
Making work pay credit was an $800 credit that was started in 2009, be available also in 2010. For people in certain income categories, the government went out earlier in the year and said, hey, we're going to reduce your withholding on your pay. We're going to give you the money in your paycheck earlier, and then when you file your tax return, we'll give you a credit for that.
And this was fascinating. I'd forgotten this. If you donated money to Haiti in the 2010 calendar, which is, of course, when the earthquake happened, you can file in your 2009 tax form?
Yeah, you could file that retroactively. There's a couple of, you know, retroactive things, and the Haiti one is the most important one for people who have made charitable deductions for the Haiti Relief Program up and until March 1st. It's an option.
All right, and that was to encourage more people to donate in the early months. Okay, well, I might have to get my hockey helmet for this one, because this is the one that a lot of people are getting notices, and they're not really explaining what it is. It's about converting your standard individual retirement account, your standard IRA, money that you've put aside that can't be taxed while you're saving it, into a Roth IRA. So explain the difference, first of all.
Well, the traditional IRA, the most common way to think of it, it's been funded from pre-tax dollars. For example, when you were working from your employer, you're contributing to a 401k account, you retire and you roll over your 401k account into an individual IRA. When it comes time for retirement, you take money out of that IRA, it's taxable.
Right. You pay the taxes later.
You pay the taxes later. Versus a Roth IRA, where you're funding that with post-tax dollars, non-deductible tax dollars today, so that in the future, when you take the money out, it is not taxed.
So you pay the taxes on the money at today's rate before you sock it away.
That's exactly it. And that's the whole program now of converting your traditional IRAs prior to retirement, paying the tax today, to convert it over to a Roth IRA with the hopes of when you take it out down the future, non-taxable.
Who's a candidate for this conversion?
Oh, typical candidates are young folks, the folks that are in their 20s and 30s. They're just getting out of college. They've started their first job. They've changed jobs. They got money in a 401k. We roll it over to the Roth IRA, pay the tax at a very low rate, if taxed at all in some cases, with a 30, 40-year run of the investment growth non-taxed.
So you only pay taxes once when you make this conversion. The money has to come from outside the IRAs. But you say that a mulligan is allowed, a do-over. Why?
I guess the worst case would be is you take your $50,000 traditional IRA and you convert it to a Roth IRA and you pay your $10,000 in tax, and all of a sudden the stock market goes down and the value of this IRA goes from $50,000 down to $40,000. You pay taxes on 50 for something that's ultimately worth $40,000. The mulligan is allowed. You can reconvert that converted Roth IRA back to your traditional IRA in 2011.
So that you go back to just paying taxes on the money that you have in it when you take it out.
That's correct.
Okay. Well, that wasn't so hard. We got through IRAs. Thanks so much. But now let's try alternative minimum tax. Some people may be facing it. This was supposed to be a tax on people with very high incomes. They weren't paying a lot of tax because they were taking advantage of loopholes. So what was the AMT supposed to do?
Well, the AMT was supposed to close those loopholes for taxpayers who were investing in tax-sheltered investments, not paying taxes because of some certain investment moves that they made. And I think the unintended results was that it was dragging in the normal, everyday, two-income working couple who's filing their tax return and is subject to alternative minimum tax, and at a lot of times at a big surprise to them.
Right, because the AMT was not tied or indexed to inflation. So suddenly you have these middle earners who really aren't making that much, but they appear on paper with the old equation to be high-income people.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And the factors that are coming into play in the calculation of AMT are rising faster than the income of the taxpayer. Mm-hmm. So it's becoming a bigger and bigger problem for us every year.
So what do you do at tax time?
Education. I'm a big believer in educating clients about the AMT system and how it works. We try to plan ahead, trying to plan for clients and whether or not they are going to be in AMT so that they could make some moves to try and avoid it.
Larry Anello, one last thing. The Bush-era tax cut set to expire by the end of this year. If those tax cuts expire, that might, for instance, I'm wondering, factor into whether or not you decide to go into a Roth IRA?
That's exactly correct. The Bush tax cuts are expiring at the end of 2010. You can pay the taxes on your Roth IRA conversion in 2010, or you have the option to declare that income in 2011 or 2012. Your choice. Where we're telling people to be wary is that in 2011 and 2012, you may be faced with higher tax rates on the same income.
And again, it will be a higher tax only if you're a high earner and you lose that tax cut.
That's correct.
Lawrence Anello, he's a CPA with the firm Del Conte, Hyde, Anello & Shook, DHAS Financial Planning out of Farmington, Connecticut. They're a part of the Garrett Planning Network. Larry, thanks so much.
Robin, you're welcome, and key is plan ahead.
A two-chord riff that helped change the face of rock and roll and belonged to the long-dormant band, The Kinks.
Girl, you really got me going. You got me so I don't know what I'm doing.
Part of the British invasion of the early 60s, The Kinks were founded by two brothers, Ray and Dave Davies. They imploded in 1996 and left a string of hits. Well-respected Man, Sunny Afternoon, Waterloo Sunset.
Respected man about town, doing the best things so concerned.
Most fans moved on, but when reporter Jeff Edgers was approaching 40 and looking at a possible layoff from the financially troubled Boston Globe, he set off on a quixotic mission to reunite the favorite band of his youth and to document his triumph in a film. Well, he made a film. It's called Do It Again, and Jeff Edgers joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What a fun thing to watch. So let's go back. Why the Kinks? What did they do to you?
I love the Beatles, I love the Rolling Stones, I love the Beach Boys, but the Kinks to me are different. While everybody else was writing about girls, they were writing about like envy of the guy who's on the football team, and I loved the drama of these two brothers who want to just beat each other up and literally do all the time.
Well, but that becomes the impediment to your doing this film. Ray and Dave Davies pretty much hated each other. Why?
There's no definitive answer, but if I put on my like sort of high school psychologist hat, to me, you've got these guys who have six older sisters, and Ray is the first boy, and you can just imagine them sort of carting him around in a wagon or something, giving him all the attention, and then Dave comes along and sort of takes all the attention away. That's as best as I can figure out.
Well, actually, you come pretty close as well when you interview Warren Zanes. Warren is the brother of Dan Zanes, a well-known children's musician now. He's been on Here and Now many times. But Warren and Dan were both in the legendary Boston band, the Del Fuegos. And Warren gives you insight into what happens when it's a band of brothers. What does he say to you?
The reality is you've got an already combustible situation when you're in a band with somebody. Then factor in being in a family with somebody and the competition that comes with that. I mean, Warren, I asked him if he, you know, remembers thinking about how much he loved the band. And he said, no, I was too busy trying to find ways to kill my brother. And I think he was. Looking back, he realizes it was a great moment in some ways. But it's difficult. I mean, it's really hard.
It's sibling rivalry times 10.
Well, right.
Here's what Warren Zanes tells you when you ask him why your quest to get Ray and Dave Davies to bury the hatchet won't be easy.
I don't get it. Why? Dave's 61 years old now. You know, Ray's 65. You know, why can't they...
Read a little Freud. We are who we were then. What happened then defines who we are today. So should he at 61 suddenly not have the voice of the kid who was deprived of something he felt he needed to live his life? Because he's 61, should that be gone from inside of him? He would be the exception.
Jeff Edgers, you are undaunted. You forge on in what you call a sort of Sherman's March with guitars. Sherman's March is the documentary in which the filmmaker becomes the subject. So now the subject of this film is you trying to get Ray Davies to talk to you. And in the process, you meet with producer Clive Davis, actress and singer Zooey Deschanel, Sting. And these people were not told that part of your interview is going to be that you're going to try to get musicians, obviously, to play a Kinks song with you. Here's a little bit of that interaction with Sting. And what struck me is that how much he knew, how much he remembered. Let's listen.
You can do it if you try. All you got to do is set me free.
About that song. That's a great song, and it's so simple in some ways, right?
I think I stole a bit of the song.
For what?
Set you free or something. If you love somebody, set me free.
It's amazing how many people were influenced by the Kinks.
I think that's because people don't realize until they actually hear the song titles how many fantastic songs the Kinks had. There's a lot of passion for them. That's, you know, why I did this.
Meanwhile, here you are thinking that maybe this quest is a midlife crisis. Your employer, the Boston Globe, is in a mess. We've covered this story. The New York Times, which owns the Globe, was threatening to shut the Globe down if workers didn't accept wage and benefit concessions. Those concessions came. So now you're looking at this perhaps foolhardy quest of making a documentary with less money than you had before. But you go to London, to a place called the Boston Arms, where a King's Convention is held every year. And they get a real treat at the convention because there is a surprise appearance.
This should happen more often.
Ray Davies shows up, the guy you've been stalking for months, trying to get a hold of. Let's listen to a little more.
The music's always spoken for me, even though I try to sort of make speeches. I'm not very good at it.
I have to script me nowadays. But anyway, I just want to say thanks. Have a good time. I'll tell you what, can we do that one again? Just do it from the second group. The last group. Days I remember all my life.
Jeff Edgers, you're in the same room with Ray Davies, the subject of your mission, but he slips away. Then later, you have a very poignant sit-down interview with his brother Dave Davies. Let's listen to a little of that.
I think Ray was probably happy once. Well, no, I think he was happy for a whole 3 years in his life. And that was from the age of 0 to 3, when I wasn't there. And I think I kind of rained on the parade a bit. And I think, sadly, it never went away.
Boy, Jeff Eggers, I mean, hearing that, it's like anyone who knows of an older brother and a younger brother and how much a younger brother wants so badly, you know, to have his older brother's love. And to hear that, that's heartbreaking.
When I was there with Dave, I suddenly felt like failure was an option. And perhaps it was the main success that I could have.
Failure would be your success.
Yeah, it was wrong for me, this total outsider fan from Boston, to be trying to force them into the room together. If they want to get in the room together and work that out, that's their deal.
Well, in the end, it's Warren Zanes who tells you really what gets lost when siblings fight like this. It's a sense of family, and it's very sweet. You end up with family and friends singing the Al Yankovic version of Lola, Yoda.
I met him in a swamp down in Dagobah, where it bubbles all the time like a giant carbonated soda. S-O-D-A soda.
Was there some sort of sense on your part, you know, wow, having seen what they lost, I'm more appreciative of what I have. You have a terrific family.
The reality is, I never thought my family was at risk, but people will go up to me at film festivals and say, are you guys still together? And I say, yeah, my wife's going to give birth, you know, in April.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And it wasn't like, I don't know if this is going to last, but let's have a child. I mean, it was always, you know, she was always supportive about it. My daughter was okay with it. They just were sometimes annoyed that there were cameras in our house all the time when they hadn't really signed on for that kind of deal.
That's Jeff Edgers, a reporter for the Boston Globe and now a filmmaker and star of the documentary Do It Again, his quest to reunite the Kinks. For more on the film, go to our website, herenow.org. And Jeff, I know you have to get back. You've got a deadline for something at the Globe, so thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service NPRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.